was in China. We were studying with a number of young men, very bright college students. You got to remember that they're carrying on a conversation about a lot of this stuff in a second language. And many of us have trouble carrying on this same conversation in our original language. So they are indeed very bright. But we were reading some of the stories concerning Jesus. And after we got done with some of these and talked about that, one of the young men, it was his first visit with us, and he was very quiet, and you could tell the wheels were just turning around. So I've learned in those situations, just sit quietly and look at them and give them an opportunity to speak, and they usually do. And so he looked and he said, "Why do you believe those stories?" And that was a very intelligent question, considering what we have done. So I asked him, "Do you have another hour?" And he said, "I have all afternoon." I said, "Good." And so I had been working that week, and I guess this is providence. I don't know how else to do it. But anyway, just was working that week. And a lesson that dealt with that very question, why, when we read through the New Testament stories, why do we believe that? Why do we take that at the value that it was given? And years ago, clear back in 1990, U.S. News and World Report, one of their articles stated basically some extraordinary event occurred in Jerusalem to account for the radical change in the behavior of Jesus' disciples. And the point that they were making at is that whatever else you want to say about the New Testament times, when you see what happened with the apostles, they changed their religion, they changed everything about their religion, they changed their occupation, they gave up all of their family and their friends and their homes. They lived and they traveled and were persecuted. And in spite of all of that, they persevered joyfully telling the same story over and over and over again. And they never deviated from that. And regardless of the persecution, they simply told the same thing. Now, I'm going to approach it tonight from a little different viewpoint. And y'all probably not going to be able to do this because I can't do it very well. We're going to be telling exactly the same stories and we're going to look at the Scriptures, but I want to look at them not as an inspired record. I just want you to see that if we took the book as a historical document and just read it as we would read any of the history that was written back then, we would begin to see why the lives of the apostles got changed. And it really is that simple of a lesson. But what makes it difficult is we want to look at them a little bit differently when we read through these. First of all, why do we believe that these are good historical records? And the first thing is because they were written in the first century. And the less time period you have from the time that it was written to the time that the events happened, the easier it is to have an accurate statement of what was going on. And everything that we read about these points to the fact that these were written by people that lived in the first century. They knew places and dates and times and funny things about each other and funny things about the situation that you just could not know unless you were there. When we talk about these manuscripts evidence, one of the other things that's absolutely, the first time I saw this and tried to figure out what was going on, I was blown away is the expression we would use. Because when you take a look, for example, at the other writings of history from this, and we don't have a lot. Do y'all realize that most of the writings from the first century just did not last? They were lost, they were burned, they were destroyed, they disintegrated. But, for example, with the history of Caesar, it was written about 44 B.C., and the earliest copy we have of it is about 1000 A.D. And so what happens is you have a 1,000 years between when the events transpired and the first copy of that which we have. And we're not sure when it was written, but we just know that we don't have any copies. And so I read through this, and those types of numbers always bug me. So I did it differently, and I made a bar chart. Now, the bar chart, where the blue starts is when the document was written, and where the blue ends is the amount of space that you have between the time that was written and the first copy that we have. And so, for example, Caesar was 1,000 years. With Plato, there was 1,200 years. With the writings of the Roman Tacitus, there was 1,000 years. Thucydides, there was 1,300 years. And so, but you can see what we're talking about is they're all almost 1,000 years. Just huge time gaps from what we have in the first one. Now, people that study history, they have no problems with these books. They pick these books up, and these are the source books of what we know about history back then. Well, what happens when you pick up the New Testament? And the time from the first writing to the copies that we have is about 40 years. Push it to the most liberal of the radical scholars that we have from a generation ago, and it pushes it up to about 100 years. And I think they're just flat wrong. But even if you're talking about that, the difference between the historical documents and the New Testament, why not take the New Testament as a historical document? In the realms of history, it is far more creditable than any of the other documents that we have. They were written not by third, fourth, fifth hand reports, but they were said to have been written by eyewitness reports. And they gave details that I'm convinced you would only have known if you were there. But they said, for example, in 1 John, what was from the beginning and what we have heard and what we have seen with our eyes, what we have beheld with our hands and handled concerning the Word of life. That's what John was writing. It was not what somebody else said they saw, but what they had seen and what they heard. Peter said, "We did not follow cleverly devised tales when we made known unto you the power and the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, but we were eyewitnesses of His majesty." Peter says, "I'm telling you what I saw. I was there. I heard this." This is the historical account. They wrote history, not legends. One of my favorite writers was a man by C.S. Lewis. Many of you have read some of his writings. He was a man that his Ph.D. and scholarship was in mythology. And one of the things that he loved is when somebody would make the statement, "The Bible is nothing but a myth." And C.S. Lewis would always ask the same question, "And how many myths have you read?" Because they've never studied myth and mythology. That was his field of study. And his point was this: I have read myths, I have studied myths, I have written a Ph.D. about myths, I know what a myth is, and I'm going to tell you one thing. The Bible does not fit that category. What category did it fit? And the answer is, it fit the same category as all of the historians that wrote, such as Tacitus and Thucydides. So it was not the writing of events. And they were writing about public events. And these things would have been easy to contradict, because there would have been people alive that said, "That's not what happened at all." And they would have simply written rejoinders and talked about that. They were hostile witnesses. And what that means is, many of the people that are quoted in this, if you quoted them accurately, they would have been upset. If you quoted them inaccurately, they would have really been ticked. putting words into their mouth that they did not say. And so to quote these people and what was included was not just always favorable to the storyline. And then there was an internal consistency within the writers of these. And this is something that you can't get unless you simply have people that were there and saw that. So when you just look at the books, they look at a history book. It reads like a history book. It pick it up and it's telling you a story, and it includes personal details, parents and places and dates and politicians. And we've collaborated a lot of that with archaeological detail. Now, there's lots more to come because that's just a very quick list. What did they teach? When we pick it up and just begin reading it, not as a religious book, just pick it up and begin reading it, what does it teach about what took place back in the first century? Just grab it as a book of history. And when you do that, we can learn a great deal about the first century people and what they perceived and understood about Jesus. By the way, I have to make this point. Just because a man is writing because he's trying to prove something does not mean that he is wrong. The obviousness of that is this. When the Jesus Seminar wrote books to prove that the New Testament was not accurate, they had a bias. They started off believing that the New Testament was not accurate, and they were going to convince you that it was not accurate. So they wrote from a religious bias standpoint. And my point is, that doesn't prove them right or wrong. The facts prove you right or wrong. And you simply have to put away the prejudice and go back and look at what do we see from history. Well, when you look at it as a history book, it talks about people like the high priest, and it has them correct. There was Annas, who was a high priest, and then he was put out of office, and his son-in-law, Caiaphas, was put in as a high priest. There was the Sanhedrin, and they would have been the ones that you would have taken a capital trial among the Jews before them. There was a Pontius Pilate. We have a namesake from archaeology that shows he was a real man that lived during this time. And if Jesus would have been tried, he would have been tried in front of Pontius Pilate. There was the family of the Herods. And what we see is that there was, in fact, a Herod that would have been the man that would have ruled over Galilee during this time and would have wanted to see Jesus. This is what you read in the New Testament. And it's simply people of New Testament times. It is simply people of the first century. And everything that we know from other events, they're characterized. Herod was just a rotten family. I was writing about a 6-page article about them the other day, just for the fun of writing that. And I'll tell you what, the longer I wrote, the madder I got. They were just ungodly from the core. And when Jesus stood before Herod, he wouldn't talk to him. He had wanted nothing to do with the man, wouldn't even communicate with him and his family. And when Pilate took a look at Jesus and he finally said, "I find nothing wrong," that would have been true from a Roman perspective. There was nothing that Jesus did that violated the Roman law, and that's what you would have expected. I don't know where I picked up that line, but somebody in reading this said, "It's a great day for a public killing." And what they meant by that is they had already decided to kill Jesus. And so the chief priests and the officers saw Jesus. They cried out, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" Why didn't they cry out, "Shoot him"? Well, because they didn't shoot people back then. Why didn't they cry out? And see, there's an electrocute him. I mean, there's any number of ways that people have used to put to death. But that phrase alone implies and tells you this was a first century people dealing with what they did. The Romans, this was their way of killing the bad criminals. They killed other ways, but when they wanted to make a public example out of people, this is what they did. But before they had him crucified, it says that Pilate took Jesus and had him flogged. And when you read the other Roman histories, this is what they did. Before they nailed you to the cross, they beat you half to death. In fact, many people died from the scourging that was given. And what we have found is examples of the scourging instrument, sometimes called a whip, but we think of, you know, Cowboy Bob and the whip. But this was a multi-thonged instrument with bones or pieces of metal tied into the middle of it, and usually not that long. And they would tie your arms around a pole until your back was stretched, and every time they hit, it would just literally cut through the back and through the muscles until eventually all of your innards were simply exposed, and they scourged. Well, this is what Romans did. This is what you would have expected to find in a book that simply talks about history. And so John said in chapter 19, they took Jesus and they went out bearing his cross to the place called the Place of the Skull, which in Aramaic is called Golgotha. There they crucified him, and with him two others, one on either side, and Jesus beside them, or between them. Now, here's another interesting thing. Why did he say that it was called such and such in Aramaic? And the answer is because that was, in the first century, one of the commonest language that they used in the area of Judea. And so, when they came out to this place, Pilate wrote an inscription and he put it on top of the cross, and it read, Jesus Nazareth, the King of the Jews. And many of the Jews read that inscription from the place where Jesus was crucified near the city, and they wrote it in Aramaic and in Latin and in Greek. And again, I don't know why you would do that, except when you study the first century, those were the three languages. This was a multi-language place. And so they put it on top of this so everybody in whatever language they could read. This is just the way history works. Now, it's an interesting thing. If you look at on your left, there's a little picture of the cross. That's a drawing because we do not have a picture of Jesus on the cross. And the drawing puts a little plaque up at the top of the cross. And what we've learned from history is that is what Romans did all of the time, because they wanted to put what the person there was accused of so that everybody that walked by could see, if you do this, this is what happens to you. And so when they put this little plaque above Jesus, this was an absolutely normal Roman first century thing to do when they crucified somebody. And they took him out to a place that was called the Skull. And we don't know if that is true, but I want you to use your imagination and look at the picture on your right. Can you see the two eyes and the nose and the mouth? We don't know if that's really the place of the skull, but what we're getting at is this. It was a place that was commonly known in Jerusalem. And it was a common place name for that, and it was just outside of the city, and it was a place where they took them and they crucified them, and Jesus died. Interesting thing, the Journal of American Medical wrote an article about this some time ago, and a little quote right out of the middle of the article, they simply said, crucifixion was intended to torture the victim for days. They had processed this so you did not die in a hurry. And one of the ways they did that is that they took your legs and they nailed your ankles right to that beam. And that way you could have something to push yourself up with. And lo and behold, I mean, that's been laughed at. Nobody would do that. But we have actually found the nail of somebody, was not Jesus, but somebody, and it was still in the ankle bone. And that's the picture of that. And it's part of the ankle with the nail stuck through that, and it would have been into the bone. My point on this is this. That's the way Romans did it. If you were there and you were writing history, you would have simply said that they would have nailed the hands and they nailed the feet to the cross, and then he would have died. And as he was there, he died, and the centurion saw that he was indeed dead, said Matthew. And so Mark says, Pilate was wondering if Jesus was dead by this time, and he summoned the centurion. And he questioned him as to whether he was already dead. And ascertaining this from the centurion, he granted that the body of Jesus was given unto Joseph. John said, when they saw that he was already dead, they did not break his legs, but one of the soldiers pierced his side with a spear, and immediately there came out blood and water. And the point that we're getting at with this is, this again is just the way that they did people on the cross. And by using your legs, you could push yourself up and breathe and prolong the agony and the time that you were alive. And if you wanted them simply to die quickly, you just take a club and break their legs. And they cannot push up and they suffocate in a matter of minutes and they're dead. But they didn't have to do that with Jesus. So when it was evening, there came a rich man, Joseph of Arimathea, and he was a disciple of Jesus. He went to Pilate and asked for the body, and Pilate ordered it to be given to him. And Joseph took the body, and he wrapped it in clean linen shroud, and laid it in his own new tomb, which he had cut in the rock. And he rolled a great stone to the entrance of the tomb, and he went away. And Mary Magdalene and the other Mary were there, sitting opposite of the tomb. Now, this was not a huge area. And so here they were, and they were looking at this tomb. But another historical fact, how did they bury people if they were Jews in the first century? And the answer is, what they did was they wrapped them up in burial cloths, and they put them in a tomb. Well, what did they do, according to the story? They wrapped him in the burial cloths, and they put him in a tomb. And this tomb is like many of the tombs that you can go and see if you take a trip over to Palestine and Jerusalem and Judea. This one was cut out of solid rock. There was no chance for a rear entry or exit. There was no chance for an escape because they didn't put air holes. Dead people don't need air holes. So it was intended simply to keep out people and animals. And so the last thing that they would have done is that they would have rolled a great stone. And so the women who had come with him from Galilee, they saw the tomb and they saw how his body was laid. And they returned and prepared spices and ointments on the Sabbath day. They rested according to the commandment. Now this is another one of those funny things of history, because I'm going to be honest with you, between you and me, I probably would not have used spices that way. They were very expensive to have, and they're not going to cover up the smell of a dead body. And besides, you put it in the tomb and you've closed the door and rolled it and sealed it shut, and it doesn't really matter whether it smells good or whether it doesn't smell good. But this was a burial custom in the first century, and so they did write it as a history. They wrapped the body. And then they went home and they rested on the Sabbath day and they prepared that. But what we have learned from history is when they prepared the body for the spices, they often used up to 100 pounds of various spices that they would wrap the body in. And then they would use great long strips and they would roll the body and keep putting the spices in as they rolled. And I'm going to tell you, when I was in the wrestling team in high school, we had to lose weight. And the easiest way to lose weight is lose water. And the easiest way to lose water is sweat. And the easiest way to sweat is work out real hard and then crawl into one of those rubber mats, those great big floor mats, and then have your friends roll that wrap up. And I'll tell you what, I don't know how hot it got in there. But then when it came time and you had enough, you had to say, help, somebody please. And of course, you know what happens with the rest of us. Most of us started laughing and went to the shower room and just left them wrapped up. Because if you are wrapped up like that, you cannot move. You cannot unwrap yourself. You cannot simply get up and leave. And so they took these, particularly if they wrapped it with 100 pounds of spices, and this is what they did. And they put a napkin over the head, and they bound it with myrrh so that there was the linen would stick together. There's no escape out of this. But even more importantly, this simply is a description of first century Jewish burial practices. It's just history when you begin reading that. And Joseph brought linen shroud, and taking him down, wrapped him in the linen shroud and laid him in a tomb that had been cut out of the rock. And he rolled a great stone at the entrance of the tomb. And when I used to read that, I thought that it was like a big ball, and they rolled this big round rock up in front of that. And that's not at all what they did. And what they did was they would have over here on, I can never figure this out, on your left, that's dumb. It's on my left too, but you go figure that one and laugh. But the point that we're getting at, on the left, there's a little trough. And what they did was they rolled this cylinder down through that trough. And there was no way from the inside to ever undo that. And this was the way that they sealed that. They didn't make wooden doors. They simply had these great stone rocks that were a disc, and they rolled them down in front. Now, somebody had a lot of nerve because that little yellow picture down at the bottom right, that's taken from inside the tomb while somebody outside is rolling the rock shut. But, you know, again, what that shows? That's what took place. This is just a historical document. If you read this with no religious bent, you would understand exactly what happened to Jesus and how He died and how He was buried and what they did with the body. They put it in this tomb, and that was exactly the thing that takes place. Now, the next day, that is after the day of preparation, the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered before Pilate. And they said, "Sir, we remember how that impostor said while he was yet alive, 'After 3 days I will arise.' Therefore, order the tomb be made secure until the third day, lest the disciples go and steal away the body and tell the people he's risen from the dead, and the last fraud will be worse than the first." And so Pilate said, "You have a guard." He gave them a guard of Roman soldiers that they could go and they could secure the tomb to make sure that nobody messed with the tomb. "Go make it as secure as you can." And they went and they made the tomb secure, sealing the stone and setting a guard. But when we set guards, we're setting Roman guards. And the interesting thing is, in the first century, they didn't have policemen. They had Roman guards, Roman soldiers. And the Roman soldiers did the police work that was there. And so if you needed somebody to stand watch and to guard the tomb, it would have been the Roman soldiers that are aligned to do that. And they would have been in 4-hour shifts, and they would have had a little squadron of 16 men, and that would have gotten them through the 24-hour day, and the people would not have been sleepy at night. And again, this is Roman history. This is straight out of Roman history books of what would happen and how the Romans would have taken care of that. And not only that, but when they secured that, we have now found a seal from the first century where the Romans, people have been tampering with graves, and so they made a decree from the city of Nazareth, of all places, and this was where a Roman garrison was held, and so they publicly said that anybody that gets caught robbing a grave is going to be put to death. And so when the Romans sealed the grave, they sealed it, they put a stamp on that, they set the guards on that, and that's exactly what you read in the first century. If you were reading about people that were afraid of Jesus and a hoax, what would they do? And the answer is they would have got a Roman guard and they would have put him in the tomb and they would have guarded the tomb. Well, what did they do? What you think they would did and what they did, that it's the same thing. That's what the book teaches. And then he was dead for 3 days. And that's a Jewish expression. You and I think of three 12-hour days and 12-hour nights. And the Jews just didn't do it that way. And they used it with the idea of all-inclusive. So 3 days, and even the phrase 3 days and three nights was simply, again, their way of talking about the 3 days. And so it would have been part of the preparation day, Friday. It would have been Saturday. And it would have been at least through the first part of the first day of the week. And what you have is 3 days that he was there. Now, you and I would not write it that way. I agree with you. I read that the first time and I'm going, somebody made a mistake. And the answer is, nobody made a mistake. What took place is they're simply writing it the way that a person would write history in the first century. This is the way that they would have expressed this. And so, then that says, when they saw the earthquake and the things were happening, the guard became frightened and said, truly, this was the Son of God. And when we take a look at the tombs, you can go see the other tombs. If you want to, there's a tomb for Muhammad. You can go find it. His body is supposedly there. Yeah, the other religious leaders. The one religious leader that that's not true of is Jesus. Now, I'm going to give you a little secret right here. This is why people want to deny the historical value of the New Testament. They're all right all the way up to this point in the story. And my point is, everything that we have read about people and places and language and scenarios and customs, everything that we've read is just a historical story that nobody would have quibbled with until you say that Jesus was raised from the dead. The problem comes is, it's right in the middle of a book that is just completely historical. And it doesn't stop there. And it begins telling the story of the changed lives of the apostles. And that's why the U.S. News report made that statement. Something extraordinary must have happened in the first century to have changed the lives of the disciples the way it did. And that's what this book simply does. It tells you why that took place. And so, there is no tomb of Jesus. I read a funny expression the other day. A writer thought that Paul had hijacked Jesus' religious reformation and had taken it and ran with it. And so he was saying Christianity is not what Jesus wanted to take place. And the way he phrased that was, if Jesus could have seen what Paul was teaching, he would have just turned over in his grave. And you know, you're just going, where does that come from? Jesus was not in the grave. Jesus would not turn over, roll around. He was raised from the dead. And you know what Paul said? Paul said, he was raised from the dead. He was not in the grave. He was teaching what Jesus had taught to be taught. And so what happens is the tomb was empty. They knew where it was. It was a brand new grave in a small area. And Joseph owned it. They didn't go to the wrong one. It was sealed and guarded by the Romans. And so they had broken the seal. The stone that had been rolled away when they got there early in the morning, it had already been rolled back and the guards had left. Something went on. They walked inside and found the grave clothes that they had wound Jesus up with and the spices of that. And the women were the first witnesses. And this is one of those funny things. In the first century, women were not called to be witnesses in the courts. Their word wasn't, you can't trust it. That's history, not my opinion, by the way. And what's going on is that this breaks the norm and simply has women that are now the first witnesses of that. And when the disciples heard this, they were skeptical. People don't rise from the dead. But then, within a few days, they're preaching over and over and over again. He is raised from the dead. And How do we account for the difference? And I'm simply suggesting this. If you'll just pick up the Bible, study it as you would any history book. Give it the same liberties you would give any history book that you read. Here is the answer that is given by the people that were there. He was raised from the dead. They didn't believe, but now they believe. What changed their mind? Nobody argued that it wasn't empty. The Jewish people, they recognized that it was empty. The Romans agreed and acknowledged it was empty. Many eyewitnesses in the first century, and they all said the same thing, that whatever happened, the tomb was empty. And Peter stood up and he preached that first sermon in Acts 2, and he said, "Men of Israel, hear these words. Jesus of Nazareth, a man attested unto you by God with mighty works and with wonders and with signs that God did through him in your midst, as you yourselves know. This Jesus, delivered up according to the definite plan and the foreknowledge of God, you crucified and killed by the hands of lawless men. But God raised him from the dead. Losing the pangs of death, it was not possible that he would be held by that." And he went on to give the scriptural reference for that. And he concluded, "Let all of the house of Israel know assuredly that the same Jesus whom you have crucified, God hath made to be both Lord and Christ." Here's the other part of the history book. What happened when the disciples stood up and preached this religious nonsense of a resurrection? It was believed. It wasn't nonsense. From the people that were there and heard the stories and saw what they did, they understood that what was just told them was in fact the testimony of eyewitnesses of what they had seen. And when they heard this, they were pricked in their hearts, and they said unto Peter and the rest of the apostles, "Men and brethren, what shall we do?" And Peter said, "Repent and be baptized, every one of you, in the name of Jesus, for the remission of sins." And you know a funny thing. In the first centuries, that's how you became a Christian. They baptized him. Another strange thing, almost every religion that claims anything to do with about the Bible practices some form that they call baptism. Why? And the answer is, it has to do with the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. How did that get started? When did it start? And the answer is, we know when it started. It started in the first century. It started right after Jesus was put to death. And the history of that is, it started because the apostles preached the resurrection. That's simply a historical aspect. But here's the other historical aspect of that. As many as heard Peter preach, received the word and were baptized. That's a historical statement. What would cause Jewish people to blaspheme the Jewish religion and claim that Jesus was God manifest in the flesh? What would cause Jewish people to forsake the Sabbath day? What would cause the Jewish people to take up a new religion and be excommunicated from the temple and kicked out of their families and to lose their job? What would cause people that had any intelligence to take up a new religion only to die within a matter of months from persecution? There's one simple answer. History. If the Bible tells history. And we have every reason to pick up the Bible and read it as history. And when you do, this is the conclusion that you draw. And so, the young man asked me, "Why do you believe those stories?" And my answer was very simply, because they happened. You pick up the book and you read it, and it's a book of history. Now, I'm going to tell you another little secret. There's lots of people in the world that aren't convinced by this. But one of the things they fail to see is they have an agenda. They started off not believing this, not wanting to believe this, and they don't intend to believe this. So I found out a lot of times evidence is filtered through the minds of people. And when it gets filtered through the minds of people, sometimes the best evidence in the world doesn't convince. Y'all done that with your children? When they come in and they say, "Dad, can you help me with this math question?" And you look down there and, "Yeah." And so you begin showing them how to do the math. And all of a sudden, they throw their pencil down and they look at you and say, "No, that's not the way Mrs. Jones did it." And you know good and well that that is exactly the way anybody that has ever done any math would have done that. And yet, you cannot convince them that Daddy knows how to do math. Until they go in and Miss Jones does exactly what Daddy did, and then they begin saying, but my point on this is evidence is just evidence until it's filtered through the brain and you sift it out. And all I'm saying is, when you deal with people, here's a good place to start. It's a history book. Now let's see what happened. And what happened was, he was raised from the dead. So, why do I believe that? I like Brother Floyd Thompson one time. Somebody asked him, "Why are you a Christian?" And he said, "I couldn't help it." And they said, "What do you mean you couldn't help it?" He said, "Well, I read the stories and I believed it. It said to be baptized, so I was baptized. The Lord added me to His people. I couldn't help it." And that's true. And so I'm just saying, if you want to believe the book, it is history. And once you begin believing it, this is what takes place. They believed and they were baptized and they're now Christians. Something extraordinary happened in the first century that caused those disciples to change, and that's what happened. He was raised from the dead. So we preach this. Don't ever back down. Don't ever apologize. Don't be ashamed of it. It is simply a matter of record. This took place. And if you believe that, you need to do what these people did, receive the Word and be baptized. And if you're willing to do that, we invite you to come as together we stand and as we sing.